An infinite peace settles his very encounter, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Mumang Khan, case 3, one finger Zen. No matter whatever Gute was questioned, he would simply raise a finger in response. And one day, a newcomer to the monastery asked Gute's attendant what the master's teaching was. The boy raised his finger. Gute heard about this, so he called his attendant and asked him about his teaching, and the boy raised up his finger. Gute then cut off the boy's finger. The boy screamed in pain and ran away. Gute called him. The boy turned around. Gute raised a finger, and the boy was enlightened. Upon his deathbed, Gute said to the monks around him, "I received my teacher's one finger Zen and have used it all my life. It has never failed me." With these words, he died. Reflections. Gute was given his name because his major practice was to chant the Dharani related to Kuan Yin, who represents infinite compassion. One of the words in the Dharani is Gute. Gute was contemporary to Hong Po and Lin Chi of the 9th century. And all the commentaries of this koan tell the story of an encounter between Gute and a nun, Jisai. She entered his hut. He's sitting zazen, chanting his Dharani. She circumambulates him 3 times and said she will take off a hat if he will say a true word of Zen. He's flabbergasted, unable to say anything. She repeats the circumambulation 3 times and repeats her questions 3 times. Gute is still unable to respond. Jisai turns to leave. He asks her to stay. It's getting dark. Spend the night. She turns, faces him. If you can say a true word of Zen, I'll stay. He's tongue-tied. She leaves. He's mortified and decides on the spot that he will stop his practice and visit Zen masters throughout China to find out what's what. He packs, intending to leave first thing in the morning. During the night, Gute dreams that a great master will come to him in his hut, so he remains and continues sitting intensely for 10 days. Tenryu comes. Gute tells him about Jisai and asks Tenryu, "What should I have said to Jisai?" Tenryu raises a finger. And in other versions of the koan, Tenryu raises his finger when Gute says something like, "What is the essence of the Buddha's teaching?" Gute's practice was to sit alone in the splendid isolation of a hut in the forest, chanting his Dharani. His practice was probably something close to what we do when we chant Om Tare To Tare To Rispaha. Then reality, in the form of the nun Jisai, intrudes upon his practice. And the name Jisai means reality. He's unable to engage with her, unable to respond to her demand for a true word of Zen. And then he realizes that his wonderful, smug, self-satisfying Zen practice is just that, meaningless. How many of us are engaged in practices that are wonderful and do great things for us? How many of us think we've got it? We're happy with ourselves. We've got Zen down. We just whip through all the cones. That's where Gute was. So realizing his practice was really nowhere, he decided to stop and find a teacher. And then the teacher appeared, and Gute's life changed. Yamada Roshi has a wonderful commentary on this koan. There's an ancient Zen text called Believing in Mind, Shinjin Mei, in which the line appears, one is everything, everything is one. In the absolute world, the world of enlightenment, the logic of one is everything, everything is one reigns. When Tenryu sticks up a finger, that one finger is the whole universe. When we stick up one finger, there's nothing but one finger in the whole universe. When you stand up, there is nothing but standing up in the universe. When Gute saw Tenryu holding up one finger, he realized clearly that the one finger and the whole universe are one. There isn't anything else that remains. There's nothing outside it. That is enlightenment. No matter whatever Gute was questioned, he simply would raise a finger in response. One day a newcomer to the monastery asked Gute's attendant what the master's teaching was. The boy raised his finger. Gute heard about this, so he called his attendant and asked him about his teaching, and the boy raised up his finger. Gute then cut off the boy's finger. The boy screamed in pain and ran away. Gute called him. The boy turned around. Gute raised a finger, and the boy was enlightened. More reflections in the form of questions. What about the story of Jisai, or reality, and Gute? Did it really happen? Is there really a Jisai? Or did the story take place in Gute's mind, similar to when Mara tempted Shakyamuni on the Bodhi Sea? Why does Jisai circumambulate Gute three times? What does she mean when she said she'll take off a hat? What is a true word of Zen? Put yourself in Gute's place. What would you respond to Jisai's challenge to say a true word of Zen? As Jisai turns to leave, Gute asks her to stay, spend the night. Does this make sense? Is it appropriate for a man and woman to be alone together in an isolated hut all night? Wouldn't that compromise both of them? And yet, Jisai says, if Gute would say a true word of Zen, she'll stay. Does this make sense? What's going on here? Why doesn't Gute rise and say, take my place? Spend the night where it's warm. I'll take some blankets and go outside and sleep under a tree. What about Tenryu's upraised finger? One of the usual responses to the sound of one hand is to raise the hand. Is this like Tenryu's one finger? And by the way, if anyone raises their hand in Daisan room for the one hand koan, they'll be thrown out. Finally, what about the saying, all things return to the one? Where does the one go? Does this saying have anything to do with the koan? Is this what the Yamada quote is all about?
Well, it sounds like Butte was just using Temme's teaching. Why is it okay for him to use Temme's teaching and the boy to not use teaching?
Who's going to answer that question? Mike.
I didn't actually hear it, sorry.
I was asking... in times past, I think we've discussed this, or maybe not, but the boy should have been using his own understanding of Zen, and yet Gute is using Tenryu's teaching of Zen to teach others. Why is that okay? But it's not okay for the boy.
I had the same question in my mind. That's my answer. I thought the same thing. Yeah, I mean, he's kind of... You can consider it a punishment, you know, cutting off a finger. Gute is cutting off his boy's finger for imitation. Well, that's one interpretation. And yet he's imitating his own teacher by raising his finger.
Is that like the comment where the... I can't remember who it is that comes into the hut and says, anyone here? And raises his hand and he says, and then it comes up, Chaucho comes up with the next tent, the person does the same thing, or maybe it's the same person. He says, yeah.
Because there's only one finger. So if you really get it, then you really understand it. There's only one. There really is one
finger. Five of them.
And that's just one hand.
When I was living in Los Angeles, I was very close to the Hollywood community, especially Norman Lear, who was very close to him, and he was the guy who did all of the family people with that producer, and also Maud, he did Maud. And he told me once that the biggest laugh they got, biggest laugh and time and all that, was when Maud said to somebody who insulted us, she said, I've got five fingers in my hand and one of them is yours.
Well, the kind of way I interpret it was a bit more prosaic. You know, that she was showing respect to just that I was showing respects as a guest to Gute by circumambulating three times. And what did she mean when she would take off her hat? I don't know, a prosaic way would be that she'd stay. She'd stay.
So I would be it.
And if he would say something to welcome her, really.
She didn't ask for that, she asked for a Zen word. Mm. What would your Zen word be?
Sit down. A cup of tea or something. So it just lies reality, you know. Reality is saying, well, here I am. You want me? You want me to stay? You know, we want to use the word reality there. Mm-hmm. If you're saying that, you know, he's lost in his sutras.
Well, Dogen says a painted rice cake is also a rice cake. So whether it happened or not, a rice cake. No, but it depends on what sustenance you take out of it.
I'd like to go back to your question. Do you want to respond to it? Is there anything new to teach? That's my answer. But this is your teaching. Whatever you say, does it come from you, or does it come from me? Something I said.
Isn't there a process where when we hear a teaching, like the teachings we're hearing tonight, unless it cuts into you and it makes sense to you, it's foreign to you. And that is the situation. And we assume that the situation between Tenryu, you didn't go into that Tenryu in the day, is that it became his. Ananda had the same situation with Shakyamuni. He was his attendant for 20 years. He attended every Dharma talk of Shakyamuni. It never was his teaching. Even though he had a photographic memory, and he was able to quote Shakyamuni, but it wasn't his teaching. And so Mahakashapa became the next Dharma here, not Ananda. Well, we think it should be Ananda. It was Mahakashapa. Only when it became his. Only when he didn't say, thus have I heard. That's why it doesn't happen here, but I remember it used to happen a lot. Steph says, you know. I don't want to hear that.
I do like Margaret says.
What you're saying reminds me of what you both have said about the intention of holding the stick when you're teaching. And correct me if I'm not saying this correctly, but that it's supposed to remind you or help you stay in the frame of speaking from the Dharma or in the mind of Buddha, is that right?
In a way, it represents Buddha's hand. So it's an extension of Buddha's hand. And which is symbolic of this teaching. Yes. And it's a reminder that what we are doing is teaching Dharma. So if that's what you're saying. Yes. To me, though, it's actually more intimate than that. It's when I'm holding this stick, I feel connected to Shakyamuni in a way that, I mean, I feel connected to him anyway, but there's something really, it's like I'm really holding his hand.
When the boy's finger is cut off, how
I can't hear you, sir.
When the boy's gute cuts off the boy's
finger,
how does he know that the boy is misusing it or is not enlightened?
I don't know. That's just what the text said. The fact is, the text also said he was enlightened, but after he called it again and raised his finger.
And yet you know if someone is speaking authentically from their heart or if they're just parroting. I mean, you know that. If you've ever taught anything in Sunday school, does anyone disagree with that? You guys were professors, don't you know, when somebody's just quoting what they read and doesn't really understand it?
So usually when someone raises a finger at me, I know that.
I think more people should be called on the fact that they are parroting something back. Because it's they're not doing the person doing the parroting any service at all to let them get away with it.
You cut off their finger.
But there is an aspect of learning which involves repetition as well. And like at the beginning you do parrot, but eventually it does become your own voice, so it's a kind of gradual process.
Yeah.
That's only the way, you know, the jazz guys,
otherwise
they imitate a lick and then try to add something.
Otherwise there'd be no continuity, would there?
Yes, you need some place to take off from.
Yeah.
Well, in jazz, there are chord patterns. And the chord patterns are always the same, but they move from the patterns and develop along melodies, really. And so the same is true here. We have a structure. We have a tradition. Hopefully, once we are grounded in the tradition, then we can move. Then we can improvise. But you need it. You can improvise from something.
Yeah.
Or can you improvise from nothing? I don't know. Miles Davis, I think, did that. What about,
Well, one problem is our educational system at the moment basically teaches people to be parrots. There's so many teachers that I can think of that what they expected from you was that you memorize what they had to say and were able to spew it back on an exam, and that was considered education. And very few and very memorable teachers actually engaged you in the material.
I once read an article about that phenomenon, and it looked at five different socioeconomic levels of teaching, and as you went up the scale, the question wasn't just what the answer was, but how did you arrive at that answer, if you were in the middle class, and then if you were up the next to the top class, did creative things on the basis of that, and the one that was training you to be the master elite was only interested in how you posed questions and what they weren't even interested in the answers. They were interested in the structure of the inquiry. So, if you're poor in America, you can bet that it's rote. But if you're higher than that, you actually can get.
And it is by class, by economic class.
Well, this was a pretty devastating article in terms of the way it was in the Detroit area. And it just was. Fell almost perfectly by class, depending on what percentage of unemployed or in the working class or blue collar people ended up. And you were treated peremptorily in the lower grades as if you were, as if you were defective, if you were, poor. And what would you want to understand?
But one of the consequences of all this no child left behind stuff is it's pulled it all down.
Right,
you know,
right.
Unless you can go to private schools and get out of the public system, then learning is all about rote, because that's all they want. You're rotating on it.
To reflect positively on the system itself. To make the system look better.
Well, yeah, that means it's just like the,
so we can
it's what
hold
the
up
big
numbers.
Parrot in Washington thinks we ought to.
Well, except there are things that you have to learn. That's a lot of resistance to learn.
But if you concentrate on passing the test, then there are going to be great holes in what you're going that are not covered on the test. So it's going to be very small.
Yeah, that's all that they do is they teach to the test. You know?
Yeah, a friend of mine has a very bright daughter. This girl had a vocabulary at the age of two that most adults don't have. But anyway, she put her in public school at first, and after about a semester, she took her out and sent her to public school. And she said, the teaching really is to the lowest common denominator now. And in the Catholic school, although she was still in the first grade, they teach each child each child reading material at the level at which they can read.
And all of this is contained in one thing.
I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.